Our next case this morning is Dunn against the Washington County Hospital.
May it please the court. My name is Veronica Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Lisa Dunn. The issue in this case is whether an employer is responsible for its own negligence when it has knowledge of sexual harassment and retaliation in the workplace, when it has the ability to control the harasser, even if he's not an employee, and when, despite having that knowledge and control, it fails to take effective corrective action to end the harassment and the retaliation.
So I take it that your basic premise is that once the hospital conducted the investigation into Nurse Jamie Jones' complaint, that it had reason to know that Dr. Coy was harassing the nurses, including Ms. Dunn.
That's correct.
And was obliged to take corrective action to protect all of them, even if they had not formally complained in the way that Ms. Jones had done.
The employer is responsible, does have liability to its employees once it has knowledge, and it did have a duty to Lisa Dunn to protect her, especially when she told them. Whether she considered it a formal complaint, and I use that in quotes, whether she considered it a formal complaint, it was sufficient to put the hospital on notice, and that's what gave rise to the duty. Lisa was a nurse at Washington County Hospital, and she was sexually harassed in the early part of her employment by the hospital's chief of staff, Dr. Coy. And when she complained about that harassment, he retaliated against her. And when she complained about the retaliation, it got worse. And eventually it culminated in threats to her safety and a physical assault on the hospital premises. Over the course of 2 years, from 2000 to 2002, Lisa Dunn told the hospital on at least 11 occasions about the harassment and the retaliation. She told the hospital's attorneys. She told the CEO. She told the HR director. She told the director of nurses. She told her supervisors. And the sum total of the hospital's actions was nothing to protect her. Eventually, she had to leave, and she was constructively discharged. And this litigation is the result. Now, we brought two claims under Title VII, one for sexual harassment, one for retaliation. The lower court dismissed both of those, holding that as a matter of law, the hospital wasn't liable for its own negligence, its own knowledge, its own failure to act, simply because it did not employ Dr. Coy. That's the fundamental legal error in this case. And it's based on a misreading of Berry versus Delta Airlines. We discussed it, spelled it out pretty clearly in our brief. That is a case that came from this court in 2001, and it stated that the vicarious liability standard under Title VII didn't apply or may not apply when the harasser was not an employee. And its rationale is pretty easy to understand, that employers are unlikely to give supervisory responsibility to a non-employee. But the lower court took that language and decided that employers had no responsibility, neither vicarious nor negligence, when the harasser wasn't an employee. And a court only looked at the question, is Coy an employee? No, he's not. Therefore, there's no liability. In truth, the Berry court applied the negligence standard and held that an employer discharges its duty under Title VII when it takes prompt action reasonably calculated to end the harassment. So the Berry court says that the employer can be liable under the negligence standard. The lower court here ruled that the negligence standard was irrelevant, and that's the primary legal error. The defendants don't dispute that on appeal. They don't defend the lower court's ruling. And I think that means that counts one and two must be reversed. Now, the court's fundamental error also affected its analysis of the other claims in the case: constructive discharge, equal protection, and free speech. The court wouldn't look at what the hospital knew, going back as far as 1997, about Coy's sexual harassment and his retaliation. And it wouldn't look at the hospital's failure to act despite its knowledge. It would only look at the hospital's acts. So whether the hospital sexually harassed Lisa itself, did the hospital itself retaliate against her, did the hospital try to force her to change her statement in the Jones case? And since the crux of the hospital's liability was its failure to act, of course the court found that its acts were insufficient to confer liability. This is especially true. This failing on the part of the court to analyze the facts is especially clear in the constructive discharge analysis, which requires a review of the totality of plaintiff's of the circumstances of plaintiff's employment.
Is there any claim that the hospital knew about Coy's, about the accused misconduct with respect to Coy's supposed retaliation?
Yes, there is. As early as August of 2000, Lisa Dunn went to the CEO of the hospital and told her that Coy had a copy of the statement in the Jones case, was trying to find out what side she was on, was pressuring her to change her statement. A few months later, Lisa followed that up with a note in writing and a meeting again with Melody Wilkie and with the CEO, Nancy Newby. Every time that Coy threatened her, if he told her that he was powerful and she didn't know what he could do to her, she would pass that on to Nikki Jablonski and to Nancy Newby.
Now, Judge Steele pointed out that the most serious of the alleged retaliatory incidents took place shortly before Dunn complained. So, arguably, was Dunn obliged to give the hospital a reasonable period of time to intervene and stop the retaliation? In other words, did she give them enough time?
I think clearly she did give them enough time, and that's because the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff showed that her complaints about the retaliation began in August of 2000 and continued right up until April and May of 2002. The court looks at a written complaint on April 30th of 2002 and calls that her, or the defendants referred to that as her initial complaint, but that's not accurate. The plaintiff described that as a formal written complaint, but there were other verbal, less formal complaints prior to that time. And the issue isn't how did the plaintiff characterize it? Was it a formal complaint or not? It's what did the hospital know?
Perhaps my colleague can speak for herself, but her question, one mm-hmm. I was also worried about, has to do with the particular incident.
I'm sorry.
You know, closed fist right at her face. Basically, I'm going to knock you senseless. And she quits, I think, the next business day after that?
No, that's not accurate. It seems to be at least a week's period of time, and I think a little bit more.
We don't know.
No. We're not sure exactly of the date when the assault occurred. It's sometime after April 24th and prior to May 2nd, somewhere in that time period. If that's all, if that's the only complaint, if that were the only complaint, perhaps there would be an issue about whether she waited long enough. But the case law doesn't say that there's a specific time period. And, in fact, the case law says that if it's a physical assault, less time is required.
No, but the problem is here one of attribution, right? Coy is not the employer, right?
Correct.
As you emphasized in the first part of your argument, what the employer is the hospital responding to what it knows or doesn't know about Coy.
Yes.
So we have the question that we're pursuing is, when does the hospital know enough about Coy to be treated as the sponsor of or culpable for his action when it doesn't respond. That's why this physical assault.
The battery is
questionable, right?
The day it happened, her supervisor knew about it. So the hospital does have knowledge. And it's not a question of whether the hospital is culpable for Coy's conduct. That's a vicarious analysis. It's whether they're responsible for their own knowledge, their own failure to act. They knew that this retaliation was happening as early as August of 2000, and they knew that it was escalating, that those threats were beginning, that he was isolating her. They knew about those things. The physical assault is merely the culmination of a long line of retaliation that went on for 2 years.
Forgive me, but can't we figure out the exact dates? Because when she made the complaint, she was told not to come in over the weekend, right?
Correct.
And then the following week, she quit.
Correct.
So
that's why I say it's sometime in her, that written complaint, which is not her initial complaint, is written on April 30th and given to the hospital on May 2nd. And she quits is sometime in between May 7th and May 8th. We don't know the exact date. Even if that were the only time period, the hospital had plenty of knowledge, plenty of time to act. In the past, they had summarily suspended this man's privileges when patient safety was at issue, when another nurse's safety was at issue, they immediately put that nurse on leave. They could take action prior to investigation, prior to taking effective corrective action that would have protected Lisa Dunn, and they did not. They did nothing. They referred it to a bunch of committees, but 2 years later, those committees still had not done anything. So you can look at the time period, but the question is, did they take reasonable steps to end the harassment? And that did not occur. Now, there's another issue in this case that I want to address, and that's the discovery requests. Knowledge, control, failure to act was at issue in this matter. There were affirmative defenses that the hospital asserted that it took effective corrective action, that it could not take effective corrective action, and that it could not discipline Dr. Coy.
But did you waive review of the magistrate judge's rulings by failing to file objections with the district court?
I do not believe that we did. The primary legal issue, or the legal error in those discovery orders, was that the magistrate judge decided that none of these discovery matters were relevant anymore because count one had been dismissed. And the erroneous dismissal of count one is something that we had preserved by filing a motion for reconsideration with the district judge and a motion for interlocutory appeal. So the district court had before it the opportunity to review its erroneous dismissal of count one and insisted that it had not committed an error. So this isn't a situation where the trial court is being sandbagged by the appeal of a magistrate judge's order. It was preserved, it was presented to the district court, and now it's being brought here. And I want to stress that with regard to these discovery orders, and by that I include the order granting the motions to quash, the magistrate judge's ruling was entirely dependent on the dismissal of count one. We ask that count one be reinstated, and that because it was error to dismiss it, that those discovery orders that were dependent upon it also be reversed and sent back down. In short, I'm asking this court for a clear ruling that Washington County Hospital is liable for its own negligence.
You won't accept a murky ruling even if it's in your favor?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We're here because the lower court thought Barry was murky. I didn't, but I was a lone voice in the wilderness. So I'm asking for a very, very clear ruling that Washington County Hospital is liable for its own negligence, even though it did not employ Dr. Coy. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Mack.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Mack, and I represent Washington County Hospital in this matter. And initially, I'd like to address the first issue, which was brought up by counsel for plaintiff, and that is the issue of whether third-party liability was even brought to the district court's attention in a proper manner. The plaintiff did not allege in the complaint that Dr. Coy was a third-party independent contractor and that the hospital should be found negligent for an independent contractor or third party's acts of harassment. Instead, they pled that he was an employee of the hospital. The first time this was alleged in any pleading was in response.
What do pleadings have to do with this?
Well, Judge,
plead legal theories.
Yeah, Your Honor, they have it under the law in Illinois and the Seventh Circuit law. They have to plead their claim, and they have to put forth a plain, simple.
Plead your grievance. The grievance
correct.
Here is perfectly clear.
Your Honor,
this is not. You will get no headway by trying to make a pleading point.
This isn't
resolved on the pleadings. Just forget about the pleadings.
Then I will move on.
I'll ask you a question and
sure.
Help you move on. Judge Steele disposed of a number of the federal claims on the ground that, you know, Dr. Coy was not the hospital's employee and therefore the hospital couldn't be responsible for his conduct. But with respect to the Title VII harassment claim, for example, why would it matter that he wasn't an employee? I mean, an employer has a duty to maintain a workplace that is free of sexual harassment. If the hospital knew that he was harassing nurses and it fails to take reasonable steps to stop that harassment, why can't it be liable for its own negligence? I mean, if the Orkin man comes in, and he's, killing bugs and harassing people. It doesn't matter. A hospital can always bar a harasser from the premises, engage a replacement, do all sorts of things. I mean, here the hospital had the power to take corrective action, irrespective of Dr. Coy's status as an independent contractor. And we know that because the hospital did take corrective action. They warned him to avoid being alone with nurses.
Correct, Your Honor. The reason why it's significant that we have to look at a third-party harassment versus a co-employee's harassment is really twofold. First of all, we need to look at what they have control of. You don't necessarily have control of a guy delivering coke to your office one time and the next time it's a different guy. And you don't have you could tell him to leave your office immediately right then if you witnessed it yourself. But if it happens one time and it's a different person each time.
I think, by the way, that a hospital controls its employees. One would think from your brief that employees are like puppets. They're on the end of the string. Some manager pulls a string and a person's arm jerks. People aren't that way. You control employees by threatening consequences. You say, if you continue to behave in this way, you will be fired or dropped into a pot of boiling oil or some other constructive management technique. Right? Same thing you can do with independent contractors. There's absolutely no difference.
I beg to differ that there's no difference. Obviously, you can control an employee's schedule.
You can
change
an employee.
No, you cannot.
Employees are sentient beings. You You can't even control a dog. All you can do is give incentives for people to behave in particular ways.
You can certainly change a schedule. You can certainly demote them. You can certainly cause repercussions to them.
You can change a schedule. You can throw him out.
Well, with
drop him into a pot of boiling oil.
The evidence in this case is that we did not have control over his schedule, that we did not have, although we could take him off the staff like you could take any doctor off any staff of any hospital, including any emergency room doctor in Illinois, but we could not control his judgment. We could not in any way tell him how to practice medicine. So his situation versus another nurse, for example, or a supervisor of the plaintiff is different, and that the evidence is different.
You did have the power to discipline him, right?
We had actually IDPR has the power to discipline him with regard to his license, and what we did was we took the claim and we referred it to the executive committee, and they established a wellness committee, and there was an investigation done concerning Ms. Jones.
Right.
In this case, we did not have an opportunity to investigate or remediate in any respect. Ms. Dunn made a claim on May 2nd, 2002, did not return to work, quit the following Monday on the 6th. What we did was we gave a call to her through the HR person. We talked to her, and we said, what can we do? Do you want to come into work? No, that's fine. We'll pay you. Don't come into work. We would have taken further steps if she remained on, and we did take further steps.
Well, of course, that's the constructive discharge claim.
Correct.
All right. But the hospital had been on notice of Dr. Coy's behavior. I understand how horrendously difficult it is to find doctors in Southern Illinois. I really do. But, I mean, this man was like a one-wave, womanizer. I don't even. It would certainly seem from the evidence that we've seen.
Your Honor, when Jamie Jones made the claim, there was an investigation done by Eric Trells, and he interviewed several nurses, and he did other things, and he interviewed Dr. Coy, and there were they actually referred it to the executive committee. They referred it to the wellness committee. You're aware, as the record supports, that there was a letter and a warning given to him and certain things spelled out in there. And what the evidence does show is that after that time period, Lisa Dunn is making a claim, obviously, that he continued with sexual harassing conduct. But the record does not establish that he did. Ms. Jablonski testified under oath, and that was Lisa Dunn's direct supervisor.
You don't think there's a material dispute on the question whether, after these complaints, Coy continued his misbehavior?
No, I don't, because I think the overwhelming evidence shows he did not.
No.
And I think the compelling evidence, we have the plaintiff by herself.
We have the plaintiff's own testimony.
Correct.
And you don't think the plaintiff's own testimony creates a material dispute on that question?
No, I don't. I think
on
that
what conceivable legal basis at the summary judgment stage could the court disbelieve the plaintiff's testimony?
Well,
you make your argument very weak by taking ridiculous legal positions like this.
Well, Judge, the plaintiff, when she did complain, which her formal complaint and her only complaint to management, according to the testimony of Ms. Newby, Ms. Jablonski, and Ms. Mashoff, was when she did in writing on May 2nd. She did not complain about all these things that she testified during her deposition. And what you pointed out earlier,
she did testify during her deposition. And it's, I think, rather well-established law that all the facts must be construed in the light most favorable to the person opposing the motion for summary judgment, which in this case was the plaintiff. Right?
Correct.
In criminal cases, we say that a person can be sentenced to his death on the basis of the testimony of a single informant who has previous convictions for perjury. Why in the world could this case not go forward on the basis of the testimony of the plaintiff, who doesn't even have a perjury conviction?
Your Honor, I think the lower court looked at all of the evidence, and I think they did an analysis of the facts, and they did an analysis of what the evidence showed, and I must believe that they did not find that her evidence, that her testimony was compelling, and they disbelieved it. And there is not a record.
If that's your view, you should be confessing error, because that is not a legally permissible step in response to a motion for summary judgment. The judge cannot weigh testimony, make credibility decisions, and the like.
Moving on to retaliatory discharge, which is the second point in the argument, and whether or not there was a retaliatory discharge claim, the district court determined that there was not, and that there was not a situation where the plaintiff was constructively discharged. And in order to prove constructive discharge, there must be an environment that is so intolerable that a reasonable person must quit.
Well, if the hospital, for instance, knew that Dr. Coy was attempting to coerce some of the nurses into changing their statements, and yet it did nothing, why couldn't the hospital be held, you know, to account for its failure to intervene?
The example that was given earlier about the plaintiff going to them and saying that Miss Allman, which is a fellow nurse of the plaintiff, came to her, meaning the plaintiff, and said, Dr. Coy knows about your statement. He wants you to change it. Which side are you on? The hospital did take action. Miss Newby testified in this case that she brought in Miss Allman, and she said that was completely inappropriate to go to the plaintiff and provide this information to her and try to talk her into changing her statement. And also there was a meeting with the CEO, which is Miss Newby, with all of the nurses, telling them that this is a confidential investigation concerning Miss Jones and they are not to interfere and be involved in it. So the record does not show that the hospital did nothing, and the record does not show that the hospital knew other than those accounts.
On that point, though, what about the meeting among the attorneys and the plaintiff at which
sure.
She was, at least in her version of the story, badgered?
There's one important point about that I don't know that you've considered, and that is that she was not compelled to be there. She had a choice about being there.
That doesn't matter. Why isn't that enough to get to the jury, and then the jury can interpret?
There's no evidence in this case that Washington County Hospital attorney in any way, shape, or form coerced her in any way, shape, or form, act in collusion with Dr. Coy's attorney.
But the attorney for the hospital was present. I don't know if
that's
that was
true.
You or somebody else, but
no,
the attorney
that's true.
Was present and witnessed what was going on. And why isn't
allegedly.
That enough to get to the jury on the retaliation claim?
Because the hospital attorney, there's no evidence in this case, acted in concert with the attorney for Coy, encouraged, ratified, and was involved, and really it's her own testimony and only her testimony that even occurred.
Did anything to stop it?
The meeting stopped within a few minutes, regardless of what happened. I mean, nobody's testified that it was a meeting beyond a couple minutes, less than five. So I don't know that beyond introductions that there was, before she left, there was much time to stop anything. In other words, it was a very short meeting of less than 5 minutes. Lisa Dunn did not testify that the hospital stopped it. She testified that she sat there and endured it for a few minutes and got up and left. And it was also the evidence in this case that she was not forced to be there, that she could have elected not to participate in the meeting with the hospital lawyer and with Dr. Coy's lawyer. An important point in this case is that when, after the Dunn investigation and after the warning was given to Dr. or the letter was given to Dr. Coy, the hospital was not put on notice. And when they were put on notice on May 2nd, when they were given the written note, they took prompt action. And they allowed her to stay home, and they also would have taken further action with regard to her, but she clearly did not have an intent to stay at the hospital.
Why
she
isn't her statement in the context of the Jones investigation 2 years earlier sufficient to put the hospital on notice that she was being harassed?
My point with regard to that is that they did what they could to correct the harassment that was alleged, and that is they particularly...
That's a question for the jury. We're talking about the applicable legal standard here and whether there are factual disputes sufficient to get to a jury under the applicable legal standard. So the hospital was on notice in 2000 right? Summer of 2000.
Of her
statement that she was being subjected to the same sort of harassment that the other female nurses, and in particular that Nurse Jones was being subjected to by this doctor.
You're correct that
and then her testimony is that it continued afterward. Why isn't that enough to get to the jury on the Title VII claim?
I don't believe it is. I believe the evidence in this case is completely only her testimony in and of itself. And although she testifies, she reported this to hospital personnel, it's just not supported by the record. So the trial court and the district court was right in entering summary judgment in that regard. It is clear that she had no intention of staying on after she gave the notice to the hospital of the claim that she felt unsafe at work on May 2nd. The evidence in this case, by her own testimony, is that she applied for work 2 months before and had intentions of only getting another job in an ER department and did not have intentions of remaining on while this was being addressed by the hospital. And this is also supported by the fact that she was undergoing orientation on the very day that she submitted her resignation at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. So she had no intention of allowing the hospital to, in any way, shape, or form, investigate her claim with regard to the fist to the cheek and the other things that occurred in April of 2002. Instead, it was her intention to seek better employment, that she was more interested in performing and doing emergency-type work. And under the law in the district court law in retaliatory discharge, unless the situation is so egregious and more egregious than a sexually hostile work environment.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Dodson.
May it please the court. Excuse me. My name is Doreen Dodson. I represent the appellee, Dr. Coy, in this matter. Preliminarily, I note that the appeal of the discovery orders are the only issues that were appealed and briefed on appeal against Dr. Coy. In the court below, Dunn tried through a subpoena request for production to obtain records of the investigation, a hospital medical staff investigation, the investigation done by the Illinois Department of Professional Responsibility, and through those, the medical and psychiatric records of both Dr. Coy and a non-party here, a Miss Jones. The magistrate below did consider the relevancy and discuss the privilege issues, and this court may affirm that holding on any ground that is supportable by the record. Moreover, Dr. Coy has a very personal right and privilege in the fundamental aspects of these documents and has clear standing to raise any relevancy and privilege objections. Most importantly, they are irrelevant and they are privileged. Both the records, these are records of investigations, not remedial action taken afterwards, but investigations that were done of a non-party Jones that were done 2 years prior to the time Dunn resigned from the hospital. Dunn has the sexual investigation, all of that report that was done by the hospital of Miss Jones' complaint 2 years earlier. That's referred to as the Trells investigation. She also has the letter from the corrective action that was indicated by the medical staff as a result of its investigation. She has that letter with the corrective action that was required of Dr. Coy. None of the information from either of these investigations or the medical records that are contained therein have any relevance to the issue of the hospital's knowledge of the alleged harassment of Dunn or of the action, whether or not they took appropriate action with respect to Dunn. And in fact, as you know, the Illinois Department of Professional Responsibility is an independent organization that isn't connected with the hospital at all. The focus of the law in sexual harassment cases is on the remedial action that is taken, not on the investigation. As this court has held in multiple cases, Berry versus Delta Airlines, Tupman versus WBBM-TV, the focus is on whether or not the employer took that proper corrective action.
Was there an in-camera examination of these documents by the magistrate judge?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
So it was a ruling based on the irrelevancy claim tied to the summary judgment on the Title VII claims alone, or did the judge actually address the privilege issue and look at the documents? Apparently not the latter.
The judge, no, he did not look at the documents. He did address and discuss in his rulings both the relevancy and the privilege objections. At the time he entered the discovery order, there had been a ruling on the summary judgment, on the first summary judgment. At that time, counts two and against the hospital, the retaliation, and count five against Dr. Coy remained in that suit. So he made a discussion of it and ruled. Basically, his ruling after his discussion was the fact that since count one had been dismissed, these were no longer relevant. But he discussed
so there wasn't pretty thoroughly. A privilege ruling.
Pardon me?
There wasn't a privilege ruling.
There was not a privilege ruling. There was a full discussion of it, but he didn't actually rule on it. When you read his opinion, in the last sentence of his order, the two are pushed together as though they were only a relevancy discussion. These documents also don't go to whether or not the hospital, quote, had control, and I know that's been an issue here discussed this morning, but as this court has ruled in Alexander versus Rush North Shore, hospitals typically are not considered to have control of their physicians, who are simply members of the medical staff at the hospital. These documents are also privileged. They're privileged under the Illinois Medical Practices Act and under the Illinois Medical Studies Act. They were the investigation of the IDPRs clearly under the Medical Practices Act. The other investigation by the hospital on Jones in the court below, who had made the complaint, was a patient of Dr. Coy's. This was a physician wellness committee, the medical staff investigation, and it had to do with the quality control to improve patient care.
Those are privileged. Forgive me. Am I incorrect in thinking that he was chief of surgery? Was he chief of surgery?
At the particular time, he was not, Your Honor, but there were periods when he was chief of surgery and chief of staff. But he was not at that time.
At what time? I mean, we're talking about a long period.
You're right, Your Honor. And I believe in 2000 and continuing through 2002, he was not.
He was not.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. Johnson?
I would just like to begin by clarifying that the discovery issue is not the only issue related to Dr. Coy. We've also asked that if any of the federal claims be reinstated, that the pendent state law claim, count five, against Dr. Coy also be reinstated. Defendant Coy is asking this court to decide the privilege issue in the first instance. That is something that the lower court did not decide, and the lower court should have the opportunity to decide for that issue for itself in the first instance, and we ask that it be sent back down for that purpose. Same thing with regard to relevance. You can't really decide at this point what's relevant because we don't know what the legal issues are that remain in the case until after the appeal. That's the exact reason why these things should go back to the district court. I also want to address the hospital's statement that it had no opportunity to investigate Lisa Dunn's complaints. To get to that point, you have to ignore all her previous complaints until April 30th. But April 30th, she certainly did notify the hospital on May 3rd. They have a phone call. They talk with her. They know what's going on. They know who the witnesses are. They do begin an investigation. They send it to their wellness committee and their executive committee. But nobody bothers to go and talk to these witnesses. I mean, 2 years later, when I'm deposing the witnesses to the assault, they say, nobody from the hospital ever talked to me about these things. So it's not that the hospital had no opportunity to conduct an investigation. The hospital wasn't interested in doing an investigation.
Will the record tell us if Dr. Coy is still on staff? Will the record tell us? I only want to know if the record...
The record only goes until January 11th of 2005, or the close of discovery a few months before that. And as of that time, he still was on staff, and he still had a contract. And I believe that I only know what I read in the papers after that. So the record is only going to show that he remains on staff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.